Hello and welcome to the second in the newly revamped House of Commons podcasts. I'm Emma Burnell. I blog at the Scarlet Standard, which is a Labour-supporting blog. And I'm here today, as always, with Mark Thompson, who is the highly respected Lib Dem blogger. And we're also very pleased to be joined today by Libertarian blogger Mark Wallace. Hello, Mark, and hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so I thought we'd kick off today with obviously the biggest story of the week, which is Leveson. I strongly suspect that we'll have areas of agreement and areas of disagreement, and I think it's only polite to ask our guest first what you thought of it. So, Mark Wallace.
Well, I think Leveson obviously had an extremely difficult job on his hands. He'd been commissioned by a government that perhaps hadn't really fully thought through what was going to be involved in the kind of wide-ranging inquiry they were commissioning. It seems from this weekend's press that he had a range of commissioners, perhaps Shami Chakrabarty, for example, who weren't entirely on board with everything that he maybe wanted to say. And as a result, I think we got a bit of a fudge, actually. It seemed quite confusing, even from Leveson's own presentation statement when presenting that to the press. He didn't really manage to make entirely clear what it was he was talking about. This is statutory but non-government regulation. This is something which will provide strong oversight to the press but will not involve people outside the press giving oversight. So I think it was quite a confused picture, and I'm not entirely sure that he hasn't weakened his own chances of getting what he's proposing implemented by making it quite difficult to work out exactly what it is that he's proposing.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I think when you write a report that's 2,000 pages long, was it? Having to present that in one afternoon to people who want to write about it within the next half an hour is always going to be a tough ask.
Sure.
So, I think it was not clear immediately, and still I think not clear entirely what will come out of it. And whether what he wrote in the report was what he fully intended to come out of it, or whether it was an opening gambit, which is a position that I've heard expressed by some, possibly maybe some rather hopeful people in the press. Mark Thompson, what do you think?
I mean, I think he had a very difficult balancing act. I think that he... Well, I think that he himself has been quite political in the way that he both... I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't read the 2,000-word report. I was away with relatives this weekend. And as blogging for me is a sideline rather than my main job, I kind of felt duty-bound to not spend the weekend with my relatives poring through it. But I've read various bits and bobs about it, and I've certainly got the gist of what it's all about. Mm. And I do feel he's been quite political. I mean, he went out of his way in the executive summary to try and play down, or basically spin the talk about the statutory underpinning. He's come up with his own kind of way of describing it that really is, I think it's trying to align itself with Hugh Grant's idea of a dab of statute. Obviously, he was anticipating that there was going to be a bad reaction to the idea of any kind of statutory underpinning. But yeah, I do think he had a difficult balancing act. And I think what we have to remember, it's all very well for people like us and people in the media and politicians to dismiss the idea of statutes, but he spent a lot of time looking at this and thinking about this. And he hasn't just come to these conclusions lightly. You know, he had many, many witnesses who came forward and had all kinds of evidence. I certainly feel that this is the most thorough inquiry that I can remember on any particular topic in my politically aware lifetime. And I really regret the fact that so quickly it's become about, you know, Cameron versus Clegg, Cameron versus Miliband. I wish people would take a bit more time to digest what's been proposed. And I hope that the legislation that we're hearing is being drafted, is that process is taken seriously, because I've also heard rumours that it might just be the government is going to deliberately produce legislation that will prove that this won't work. And if they're going to do that, that just seems silly. If you're going to draft legislation, have a decent stab at getting something that can work.
And what is there to stop the opposition and the Liberal Democrats, for that matter, amending the legislation until it does work? Yeah, we've seen what many might consider unworkable legislation come through the House of Commons and the House of Lords and be unrecognisably changed at the end of that process.
I actually think, from what I've heard, what might well happen here is that the legislation will be drafted, it will then be circulated, but as a means of saying, look how unworkable this is. And then it will never actually, they'll never find any government time for it, because what Cameron is trying to do here is to give the press a bit more time to just get the house in order, present their own, even Leveson wants them to present their own way of regulating themselves, but Cameron's then hoping that the story will have moved on, the regulation will be in place, albeit not with statutory underpinning, but the press will look like it's at least trying to get its house in order, and then in 3 months' time, you know what politics is like. We'll be on to the next, you know, there'll have been 10 more political stories, you know, by February, 10 more major political stories, and he's hoping that this will have been forgotten about. So I don't think that Labour and the Lib Dems will ever get the chance to amend this, because Cameron, as Prime Minister, has power of initiation, and he won't initiate this. That's what I think.
Right. Mark Wallace, as a libertarian, what do you... I mean, presumably you're against any form of statutory involvement in the regulation of the press. Would that be a fair summary?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I was very concerned in the run-up to Leveson. I think one of the things that concerned me about, as I was saying earlier, the very broad brief of Leveson, not necessarily having been fully thought through, was that it left an awful lot of openings, from my point of view, for this to go really quite badly wrong for the future of press freedom in the UK. I'm more relieved now he's issued it. That's not because I think the kind of statute he's put forward would be a particularly good thing. I've got some sympathy, a lot of sympathy, for the things the government are saying about setting a precedent of setting statutes and legislating about press at all, for that matter. But actually, I'm relieved, because I think he's left so many confusing elements that, in practice, even if people were more enthusiastic in Parliament than they are, I don't think in practice it could go through. He's left so many open questions that you may have 50 different kind of vague groupings of MPs who all kind of want to see some statute, but I suspect all of them will be so busy, if this ever was initiated, putting forward amendments, putting forward changes, dying in ditches over one thing or another, that Leveson made insufficiently clear that it never would happen.
But Mark, sorry, isn't that always the way it is with these reports and with any legislation? I mean, legislation never passes through the Commons, or at least it shouldn't pass through the Commons, without scrutiny and without amendments and without a proper, robust debate taking place where the arguments are tested and challenged. And
of course.
And surely the point of that is you get better legislation through that. So the idea that Leveson was going to come up with a blueprint for a government bill that could go through pretty much unchallenged, I don't think is realistic.
No, you're absolutely right. Obviously, the process of scrutiny and amendment is a crucial one to our democracy. Frankly, Parliament scrutinises too little and amends too little already, from my point of view.
Yeah, I agree with that.
If you have a well-functioning democracy as it was meant to be, and if you believe people who think there was a golden age once was. But I think the question is that Leveson has this peculiar situation where he wasn't actually given the brief in the first place to put forward the idea of a bill at all. You could argue from the original his original brief, he wasn't really given that much of a brief to produce a specific actual solution to the problem. He was there to investigate the practices and culture and ethics of the media as it currently is. And there you have the problem with the huge amount of evidence that's been taken, unusually high-profile evidence for this kind of inquiry, the vast number of pages in the eventual report. If you look at that, it's great that he investigated what happened to victims in so much detail. What I don't think he investigates anywhere near enough, if he wanted to put forward some full solutions on a legislative scale, was actually what kind of legislation could you have? Where was the evidence from other kind of regulatory systems around the world for press? Where was the evidence for how British constitutional law, Human Rights Act and so on would mesh with something like this? If he wanted to do that, I don't think he's got anywhere near building a basis for it.
So would you say that there is space then for a... and perhaps deliberately created space between Leveson and legislation that is actually being missed out, whereby you take what Leveson says about the current culture, and then that has not yet been, but could be developed, and obviously you would not be in favour of it, but there is a space for there to be legislation developed that would deal with the culture that has been expressed through the Leveson report.
Well, as you say, I would ultimately and absolutely oppose any kind of attempt of legislation as a libertarian. However, you know, with a kind of PR political strategist hat on, you know, if I was somebody arguing for that kind of legislation, yeah, I think you would need to go through that process. I don't think there's the political willingness to go for that at the moment. I think there's already a huge amount of confusion in Westminster as dividing lines within parties, for that matter, within the coalition, are being drawn, and people are already fighting over this. So I don't think that's something that could feasibly happen. I think either Leveson hasn't approached this task in the right way, or maybe he wasn't given a full enough brief in the first place. But you know, as a, from a libertarian point of view, I'm pretty delighted. It doesn't seem like legislation can be brought forward. Frankly, I'm amazed that the DCMS are actually talking about drafting hypothetical legislation that they don't intend to initiate, as an example. I think that's quite a surprising tactic that I don't think many people expected to really happen. So we'll see how that goes. It'll be a very peculiar event. As the other Mark says, it seems quite clear that they intend to produce that legislation on the basis of it showing that this is unworkable. But you never know. Maybe Ed Miliband will look at it and say, that's precisely what we want.
If I was a more cynical person, I might suggest that Cameron deliberately made sure that the remit of Leveson was a bit blurry and unclear, precisely so when he reported, he was able to use that as a reason why it wasn't going to be possible to implement what he'd suggested. But luckily, I'm not a cynical person, so I'm not going to suggest that that's what he's done here.
To be honest, I'm a very cynical person.
Good. So we've got one cynical person on there.
I think it's a little bit less Machiavellian than that. I think David Cameron just didn't really think about it very much, knew he had to take some action. His PR head said to take action, but you know, he's not a details man. He never has been. So he sort of said, off you go and investigate the culture of the press and come back with something. In the meantime, all the people that come from his former life is, you know, lots and lots of lobbying behind the scenes and on the front pages of newspapers has been going on ever since Leveson was set up. And it just feels, as a leader of a political party, like a bigger headache than he can be bothered to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I find funny about Cameron is that the longer he is prime minister for, the more similar to Gordon Brown he seems to become to me, in the respect of Gordon Brown was always hailed as this master political strategist. But when it came to it, what he was good at was tactics, not strategy. It was always short-term tactics, what was going to get the best headlines in the next day or the next week. And he wasn't always great at judging that either, but that was what he tended to focus on. And Cameron seems to me to be very similar. You know, he called for Leveson and set up Leveson because there was a political crisis and because it was clear he'd been far too close to people like Rebecca Brooks and obviously Andy Coulson, thinking that that would kick things into the long grass. But the grass wasn't long enough, because only just over a year later, Leveson reported and he's left with another big headache. And now, you know, he's had to basically go back on his word. I mean, if he'd thought this through, he wouldn't have made statements like, I'll implement it unless it's bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, surely he must have known deep down that he was going to be against anything statutory. And he must really have known that Leveson was going to say there has to be something statutory. Otherwise, all Leveson would have been doing was reporting in the same way as all the other commissions that they've had over the years. We keep hearing this seven commissions in 70 years. Yeah. And I know about the was it the Calman or the Calcott Commission back in the early 90s? Mm. I vaguely remember that happening. It was kind of right near the start of my politically aware time. But, yeah, I think Cameron has completely messed this up. And it ain't over yet. You know, I think there's plenty more mileage that Ed Miliband can get out of this in the next few days, maybe a couple of weeks, whilst it keeps burning. And I think Cameron's on a really sticky wicket here, because he has gone back on what he said he would do.
And the initial polling seems to be very favourable to Leveson. Now, whether that sticks or whether the continued fuss in the press about it will eventually move that polling is unclear, but certainly at the moment I don't think it's clear that Cameron is on the same side as the people, but he is on the same side as the filter through which the people may hear, read about politics, although that's, as we've discussed before, less and less true. Maybe we could go back, particularly given that we've got someone who's quite philosophically strong on the sense of a free press and freedom from legislation, go back to maybe discuss this a little bit more philosophically and talk about what is a free press and what responsibilities it has. Mark, if I could bring you in at that point.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think the first thing that I would put forward on this topic is that from a libertarian perspective, democracy, the free market and free speech are the three legs on which a free state stands. So from a libertarian perspective, it's also extremely concerning if you start transferring power over the press, you know, even in small ways, towards the state. There are already concerns, I think, in the UK about some aspect of how our civil law, for example, impinges on freedom, on free speech, particularly over libel law, which is obviously something that runs alongside the kind of things that Lewis was talking about. It doesn't seem to really crop up within his brief a huge amount, which was slightly surprising. But the interesting thing this week, and it feeds into what Mark was just saying about Cameron, is I think he's been incredibly lucky to have Maria Miller actually by his side as the new CMS Secretary of State. I think she's done quite a good job of actually picking up the particular point that, seeing as the proposal from Leveson is that this whole system would be overseen in some way by Ofcom, that, of course, it's the Secretary of State that appoints Ofcom, that we have a sometimes too simple debate and too simple concept within Britain, British politics, that you can really have an independent body which is also publicly funded, which is also publicly appointed. And I think that, from a libertarian perspective, is concerning, that you would have the first signs that if somebody wanted to use these powers in the wrong way, that perhaps they would have an ability to impinge on a free press. That's not to say, of course, that the press can simply write anything they like about anybody, whether it's true or not. I was pleased to say that I was one of the first out of the traps defending Chris Jeffries from a lot of things that were being said to him by the press. But, of course, a lot of these things are actually already forbidden, are already powers, criminal powers, civil powers that forbid press prejudicing trials. Arguably, in the Jeffries case, they were certainly not used quick enough and not used in the right way and not used to full effect. So that is of concern. But, you know, if you think about the newspaper that started this whole scandal off, the News of the World, what happened to the News of the World? It wasn't closed down by a press regulator. It wasn't closed down by the threat of legislation. It was closed down by public revulsion and by the fact that the advertisers felt that actually they were being tainted in the eyes of the people on whom they rely for their income from what this paper had done. That's why it shut.
Yeah, but to be fair, Murdoch had been toying with the idea of closing down the News of the World and replacing it with a Seventh Day Sun incarnation for quite a long time. So I do wonder if closing of the News of the World hadn't have been aligned with what Murdoch kind of wanted to do anyway, whether it would have happened in that way. It's possible it may have happened. You're right, there was a real clamour from the public, and there was a lot of revulsion, and I suppose in a way it cauterised the wound. It didn't stop Rebecca Brooks from having to resign eventually. But I'm quite interested, Mark, in just testing. We can turn into the moral maze in a minute. I'm quite interested in just testing your kind of principles there, because there are lots of areas of not so much public life, although in some cases public life, but just life in general in this country. Doctors, lawyers, even firemen, I mean, all kinds of different industries are regulated, and they seem to get along just fine. And, for example, Ireland has press regulation backed by statute. And, you know, the Daily Mail in Ireland, for example, is an enthusiastic sign. You know, they're signed up to that absolutely fine. They don't seem to have a problem with it at all. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. In your view, is the press like a specific special case that has to be singled out? Or do you actually think that maybe some of these other organisations and professions actually don't need regulation either?
And it's worth remembering at this point that television is regulated. So it's not all of our sources of news. It's one specific area of our sources of news.
Both of the things you said are very true. I think, yeah, I do think that the press, media, the idea of speech in one format or another, whether it's Twitter or dare I say on a podcast, is something that actually does have a special value. But of course, you know, I do believe where possible that deregulation is quite a good thing. The Irish example, I can't say I'm not a media lawyer, so feel free to correct me on aspects of the Irish system. But of course, don't forget, a newspaper editor has recently had to resign in Ireland for printing the photos of Princess Kate naked, which was something that did not happen within the UK in our unregulated system. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that we can say that one system works extremely well, one system is entirely rotten. When it comes to television news, you know, I think there are serious questions about the delivery of news on television being regulated. I think we fall into quite an artificial assumption through regulation of TV news that it's actually possible to be balanced. We see endless arguments from the left, from the right, from people who are pro-Israel, from people who are pro-Palestine, about bias within TV news. I think it would actually be a lot healthier if we simply said, tell you what, people are biased, but also consumers are intelligent enough to start to distinguish between the kinds of news outlets that they bring in. I don't think there are a huge number of people in this country who pick up The Guardian and think that they're going to be getting a right-wing press source. similarly, I don't think there are many people who would necessarily pick up the Telegraph and think that they're going to be getting a firebrand socialist publication. So I don't see why we can't embrace the fact that humans are biased, but that in a market of ideas, like Twitter, for example, that actually people are able to distinguish between what they're getting and choose their news based on proper information about it. We're very fortunate to live in an age where we have more information than ever before, courtesy of the internet, in an atomized way, critiquing every fact that a journalist puts out, debating and fisking the things that they write as bloggers. I'm sure we've all had people who've taken issue with things we've written, if we've got it wrong or if they think we're mistaken and so on. That's a healthy thing, and I think that actually makes us better equipped than ever before, really, to say, tell you what, bias is a good thing. I'd like to see news on television deregulated, and for that matter, political advertising allowed as well.
So by extension, Mark, it sounds like you'd be quite happy if we had Fox News over here or an equivalent of Fox News. You wouldn't have a problem with that.
Absolutely not. And I think, frankly, under our current system, to read some of the commenters on the Guardian website, you'd imagine that Sky News is like Fox News as it is. But I do think it would be
only
a good
the
Cape
Verde bit.
and I suspect actually that you're going to see this happen anyway through the internet. It's already arguably starting to occur. I suspect it's going to speed up as broadband speeds increase, as accessibility to the internet broadens, and as the cost of technology comes down. I mean,
what you're actually getting is a kind of a convergence of the different media types. So, I mean, I listen to the Guardian podcast every week. But that's essentially a radio show. In fact, I do read articles in The Guardian as well, but one of my main ways of interfacing with, you know, what The Guardian's view on things is that podcast. And newspapers are able to do video now, so you'll sometimes get little clips, usually short clips, but I don't really see how that is that much different from, you know, a short news bulletin, to be honest.
Indeed. You did have a peculiar attempt a couple of years ago from the European Commission, actually, when they were looking, I think it was Television Without Frontiers or Television Without Borders, they kind of casually titled it, which did try to define essentially any moving image broadcast anywhere, including through the internet, as being television and being regulated in the same way. And, you know, those attempts are going to happen. And, you know, they apply in mundane ways as well. How does the BBC license fee function in a world where increasing numbers of people watch through the internet?
Pretty well, from what I'm led to understand. The policing of the license fee is less necessary than most people think, because most people pay their license fee, given that it's a rather small amount of money. And until a couple of months ago, the BBC was the most trusted institution in the country, so people were quite happy generally to give that money to that institution because they trusted it to be unbiased. I think that obviously the scandals that have occurred, which aren't about their bias, in the last couple of months have rocked trust in the organisation as a whole, but I'm fairly confident they'll get through that, and you know, their self-flagellation will get them through this scandal and into the next, whatever that is, because there will always be something. For me, before Leveson came out, I started thinking about press and the importance of investigative journalism. I found myself watching All the President's Men last weekend, which is the film based around the story of the two Watergate journalists. And they had very, very strong rules within their paper. And the American press in general has quite firm rules about sources and about double sourcing and making sure you've got, you know, they really make sure their stories stand up in ways that we don't seem to have generally in the press here. And I was thinking about, I can't think of anything that's been recommended by Leveson that would have stopped Watergate coming out. And that just seems like we might be going overboard in terms of our, for me, it's not a philosophical thing. I want to have a press that works. I want to have a press that informs. I want to have a press that informs equally and treats equally, no matter who you are. And at the moment, it is well known that there is a culture, particularly in the tabloids, that your decision on whether or not you run a slightly shaky story is based on the person who the story is about's ability to sue. And that doesn't seem to me to be a press that is treating people equally.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, as a Lib Dem, and I kind of consider myself fairly liberal, although I don't normally describe myself as libertarian, I think that having a very small amount of statute to just underpin press regulation, but a set of press regulation rules that the press themselves come up with, and that the press themselves actually are heavily involved in how they are policed. So I don't want something that just replicates the PCC, because that's clearly discredited. But I'm fine with the idea that the press come up with the rules themselves, as long as everything's transparent. But my problem is that I suspect in the short term they'll adhere to it. But in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, once things have moved on and people aren't paying attention anymore, I just strongly suspect that they'll revert to type again. And that's why I think we need some kind of statute. And I think from a liberal perspective, it's all very well saying that the press needs to be completely free to do whatever they like, but we have to make sure that people who really have no power themselves are protected. And I think that that is in accordance with kind of standard liberal philosophy.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this part of the discussion up now, if that's okay. I think that we've gone philosophical, and we've also talked about the political. I'm going to finish it with this thought, which you're both welcome to comment on. If Cameron does, and it seems like he may well, kick this into the long grass, he will then have to cross his fingers that nothing else really bad comes out that happens between now and the next election. Because if the press mess it up between now and the next election and I'll found out, it will be Cameron's head on the block.
I agree with that, but I think what he'll then do is pull out the draft legislation that was put together, and he'll say to the press, you forced me into this position and now I have to legislate and it's your own fault. I think that's how he'll play it if that happens.
Mark?
Yeah, I agree that would obviously be his approach. It obviously depends what it is and when it happens, if it was to occur, God forbid. I don't think many people saw the extent of the allegations about the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone coming, so goodness knows what might be lurking out there, or people might be dumb enough or immoral enough or bad enough to do. The interesting thing to note, of course, is that if something like that does come out, I would say it would be worth putting money on it actually being a newspaper in our unregulated press that will expose it, whether it's what Malcolm Tucker called the Guardian newspaper that hates newspapers or another one, I don't know, but I suspect it will be investigative journalism that would expose something that bad happening.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that's why I think there is a line, a very fine line to be walked. I'm with Mark. I don't want to see large amounts of statutory legislation, but I do want to see a statutory underpinning that protects the victim as much as it protects the journalist. And at the moment, I do think there is an imbalance between those two. Anyway, moving on, the other big story this week was the three by-elections in Middlesbrough, Rotherham and Croydon North. All three handily won by the Labour Party with, I think, in each one an increased majority, though not obviously an increased vote, because once again, the other story was very, very low turnout in at least two out of those three elections. But also the most interesting factor was the fact that UKIP were coming very, very high. And it seems to me like if you live in the north of England and you don't want a Labour MP, it's not the Conservatives or Lib Dems that you turn to anymore. Would you say that that's fair, Mark Wallace?
It's certainly a remarkable moment for UKIP, and I think one of the reasons they'll be celebrating so much is the psychological effect this will have on voters. You know, when they knock on people's doors, as they've been doing for the last 20 years, or almost 20 years since they were founded, saying, please vote for us if you agree with us, it's been driving Nigel Farage and go crazy, having people say, well, even if I agree with you 100%, you're never going to get in. You know, the more they get second places under their belt, the more that effect will crumble. However, I think it depends where you are in the north. I think their organisation is still remarkably patchy. This is a party that has reportedly 18 or 19,000 members. It probably has, due to various bits of internal strife over the years, probably even more members, even more ex-members than it has current members, I suspect, judging by the number of people who've flounced out or fallen out or been slung out and so on. But that's still a relatively small number of activists. You know, 19,000 members, I suspect they're unusual in that almost all of their members are activists because they're extremely energised about this, and obviously they'll be buoyed on the back of this week. But Yorkshire and South Yorkshire in particular are unusually strong areas for them. I think the North East, my home region, I think there's a lot less sign of a UKIP boom. I think there's a lot less sign of a UKIP machine in the region. But it will be extremely interesting to see how much of this they can continue, where they can carry on the rise, and of course, how much of it they can convert into second places, or they'll be hoping, or they'll be claiming a seat at the general election, which I think is a lot less likely.
Mark Thompson, obviously your party have had a similar sort of history of being told that you can't be taken seriously until you were taken seriously. Do you recognise that? And what would your advice to UKIP be at this point, in which does feel like a tipping point in their respectability? Other than don't go to government with the Tories because it doesn't do you any good.
I think UKIP have done very, very well in recent years, and particularly well in the last week. I mean, I wrote a piece a few months ago where I think I titled it, I for one welcome our UKIP overlords. Because, for anyone who isn't aware, that's a Simpsons reference, look it up. Because one of my main political preoccupations, some might say obsessions, is electoral reform. And the better UKIP do, and still don't get any MPs, the more there will be a clamour for some kind of electoral reform. I mean, if hypothetically UKIP got, say, 9% of the next election, they probably still wouldn't get any MPs because of our electoral system. Because UKIP's support seems to be fairly evenly spread throughout the country. There was actually an excellent blog post by a Cambridge mathematician, Fields-winning mathematician, Tim Gowers, last year during the AV campaign, where he basically took apart the No to AV, lots of their arguments. He kind of proved that some of them were just wrong mathematically. Being a bit of a kind of maths and stats geek myself, I quite appreciated it. But one of the things he said, which really stuck in my mind, was that basically, if you want to win under first past the post, you have to make sure that your support is geographically concentrated in certain areas. Because if you were to get 28% across the entire country, you'd probably get no MPs just because of the way the system works. So I think UKIP could still be doing way better than they're doing at the moment and not get any MPs at all. But maybe we'll put that to one side, because that's obviously to do with electoral reform and probably not the main people's main concern. I know. Can you believe it? I know. Yeah, I was surprised myself. But in terms of how well they're doing, I think, yes, they are doing very well. You can't deny it. They came second in Rotherham. I think they came second in one of the other ones as well, didn't they?
In Middlesbrough.
Yeah, but Rotherham was particularly striking because they got nearly 5,000 votes, and the winning Labour candidate only got just under 10,000 votes. So, you know, they were more than halfway to winning that seat, and considering where they were even just a few years ago, that is quite incredible. But they will find it very tough. And I agree with Mark about the organisation question. It's never really felt to me like they have a particularly good on-the-ground campaign. Maybe during by-elections it's a bit different. You know, maybe they can do a little bit like the Lib Dems used to do, and still do, which is pour resource and people into particular constituencies and just really fight street by street to do well in by-elections. And who knows, with that strategy, it's possible at some point they may win a by-election just by concentrating their fire in one particular place. But you've got to remember, in 2010, Nigel Farage, who is by far and away their most well-known politician, and he's a pretty charismatic guy who comes across very well on the media, came third in the seat where he stood. And, you know, it was a seat where people were saying before the election that he had a chance of winning it. And in the end, he came pretty much nowhere. So you've got to remember what a big mountain that they have to climb here.
Yeah, I agree about that. I think, you know, there are a huge number of obstacles still in UKIP's way towards actually getting an MP elected. I think this week has perhaps shaken a few of those obstacles. The big question for me is whether UKIP, I mean, there's always this debate, do UKIP take votes from the Tories, they take it from Labour, do they take it from the BNP, etc., etc. I think the question is, are they taking votes from people who voted before, or are they taking votes from people who would not otherwise vote? If they're starting in some parts of the country to unlock the kind of access to the pile of people, increasingly, you know, depressingly large pile of people who don't come out to vote at all, then that could be very interesting indeed, because it becomes extremely difficult to predict, based on likely to votes and all the rest over previous years, how things are going to go on the day.
From what I've seen, Mark, I think it's a bit of all of the above. Mm. I think they take votes from Tories, obviously, but they also do take votes from Labour. They've taken quite a lot of votes from the Lib Dems, certainly in the last couple of years, and that would seem to be the Lib Dem vote, or the former Lib Dem vote, that was largely a protest vote was almost an anti-politics vote. I mean, UKIP are hoovering up the anti-politics votes at the moment. And not having any MPs is a big advantage for trying to position themselves like that. I do wonder if the situation with UKIP will start to feed on itself. I think that's what has happened with the Lib Dems in the past. When they've started to do quite well in certain places, people start to realise that actually, maybe these people can win. And that's certainly how very hard-working candidates have fought over maybe two or three election cycles from, a distant third to eventually winning the seat, because people start to realise that once, the party's come a strong second, they could actually have a chance of winning, and then they can start to do the classic squeeze that Lib Dems are, well, all parties do this, but Lib Dems, will say, well, you might want to vote Labour, but, Labour can't win here, so you need to vote Lib Dem, and in order to keep the Tories out, that sort of thing. Maybe UKIP can start to play those sort of games if they can start to come a strong second in certain seats.
Perhaps we'll start to see UKIP winning here posters going up. purple sprayed over the yellow ones.
Oh God, saved from the bar charts.
They definitely need to get good at bar charts.
I think there's some, the aspect of the kind of snowballing effect, I think, is one that, I'm a member of the Conservative Party. I think that, there is a threat of that affecting the Conservatives, that actually the more people think this is a viable option rather than purely a protest vote, then, the more likely people are to defect, not just for the reason of being absolutely bloody furious. And in its same way, that will affect UKIP's perception. If, there was a time when, 99% of the UKIPers that one would meet were, so furious about the situation they're in, or so furious about whichever party they left or whatever, that actually I suspect that put quite a lot of people off. If they have people who are joining, even out of, say, reasons of self-interest in terms of viewing this as a decision that could bolster their careers, then that could change people's day-to-day experience of meeting UKIPers or seeing them on television, and, that will have its own effect.
Okay, Mark, now I promise I'm not going to do this to you every single week, but we won't have by-elections in which your candidates come eighth every single week. I was reading through some of the reaction online to what happened to the Lib Dems, and it reminded me of the quote that we were discussing previously from Karl Rove during the American election campaigning. I don't know if anyone's seen it, but there's a point on Fox News when Karl Rove is fighting back against them calling Ohio for Obama, where he's asked the question, isn't this the kind of mass Republicans do to make themselves feel better? And what I read, particularly Mark Valadares's piece on Lib Dem Voice, and it just, in my head, I thought, isn't this the kind of electoral criticism that Lib Dems are doing to make themselves feel better?
I don't think there's much I can say here that's going to be positive about the Lib Dems. Coming eighth in any by-election is terrible. And I've never been the sort of activist or commentator who tries to pretend that things are good when they're not. To be honest, it drives me nuts when you see party politicians on election night. And I remember seeing it was a few years ago, I think it might have been the local elections, and I know Margaret Beckett was one, and there were two others, so there was a Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative, and Paxman said to each of them, what about the results we've seen so far? And each of them painted an absolutely glossy, rosy picture for their individual parties by picking out specific elements of the results. And Paxman just kind of sneered and just said, what, so everything's perfect for everyone? I think there's a real danger that the Lib Dems could, in the next year or two, just kind of sleepwalk into an electoral massacre by convincing themselves that they don't need to worry about this because it's midterm and all the rest of it. Mm. We've never been in government before, that's true, and our vote share does, and our polling share does dip during the midterm of a parliament. But we're in uncharted territory here, and coming eighth in a by-election and losing our deposits is a terrible position to be in, and I do think we need to be careful here that we don't, that we don't just kind of shrug our shoulders and think it'll all come good come 2015. Having said that, there's no easy answer to what we do about this. We are still in government, and that isn't going to change anytime soon. I can't see the Lib Dems pulling out of the coalition. I think that would probably, if anything, make things worse, because all the stuff about trying to make sure that the Lib Dems can prove that coalition works, that'll all go out the window if we pull out of the coalition. What they'll have effectively proven is that coalitions can't work, or at least in this case, coalition didn't work. So I don't think that they can do that. So I can't come up with a prescription for how we're going to sort this out, but I definitely think we need to take heed of what's happened here and not just be complacent about it and think that it will all come good, because it may well not.
Okay, and finally, our Fluffy Duck story. We've got the is it the pre-budget statement? I forget what they're all called these days.
It's meant to be the autumn statement, but it's in December now for some reason.
That's right, yeah, the autumn statement on the 5th of December, which, I mean, if they can't even get that right. We don't know what's going to be in it. We've all heard a few rumours. But let's one thing that you'd love to see in the autumn statement. Mark Wallace, you first.
Fracking. I think this is something which offers a huge amount of opportunity to the UK economically, in terms of the opportunities for accessing shale gas, building up skilled industries, particularly in Lancashire, for example. But also I think it's something that seems quite likely, from what I'm hearing, that the Chancellor is going to essentially put in place a very favourable tax regime for the exploration and eventually exploitation of shale gas. So that's something that, you know, from my point of view, not particularly liking the idea of Vladimir Putin being at the other end of our gas supply pipeline in the winter, is positive news. And I think hopefully it'll be something that actually could make a difference in a big way to the economy, say, over a 2.5-year period.
Mark Thompson?
Well, I would like to see more infrastructure investment. I think we really need to do something to kickstart the economy. I fear that we could be moving towards a triple dip at the moment. A few weeks ago, I didn't think that was likely, but some of the murmurings I've been hearing are starting to make me wonder. And I know the government has made noises about infrastructure investment, and I know it can take quite a long time. But there are things like, you know, we really do need houses. We really do. I mean, I'll declare my interest. I part own a company that works closely with the construction sector. And so any boost to construction will help me. But even if I didn't work in that sector, I'd still be saying this, because I think it's one of those things in the economy that can really just help. It can help create jobs. It can help with the engine of the economy to just, you know, as it's stuttering, to just keep it going. And it is something that government can do. And I get the feeling that politicians of all parties actually really want this, and I struggle to understand why it doesn't happen. I keep hearing talk of it, and then it just never really seems to happen. I mean, you probably couldn't find a politician who wouldn't at some point say, we need more houses, and yet they don't seem to get built. Actually, Emma, you used to work for a part of the Labour Party that was focused on housing, didn't you? Do you have any insight into why that might be?
I didn't work for a Labour Party. I'm a current member of the executive of the Labour Housing Group, but we don't have any staff. In fact, other Mark, I used to work for the CERA, which is the Labour Party's environment campaign. So you can imagine my feelings on fracking are slightly different from yours.
Indeed, yeah. A new, relatively cheap, relatively low carbon fuel, I bet you're massively in favour.
Yeah, it's not just about carbon. But going back to housing, the reason it doesn't happen is because everybody thinks we should have housing, and everybody thinks that housing should be over there. And this has been and we got out of the habit of getting used to building houses here. When we were building houses at a huge, huge rate in the post-war, people got used to the idea that houses, you know, and now everyone is protecting their little bit, their little corner of Green England, whether that's the common down the road or whether that's, you know, the Greenfield site. But people are very protective of an overboiled housing market because people own the houses in that overboiled housing market. And I think it has to flip, because eventually people's children won't be able to buy ever. But at the moment, we're seeing people have woken up in the last 2-3 years to the fact that we absolutely have a housing crisis. They haven't woken up to the fact that housing crisis has to be solved in a way that might be slightly painful for them and their voters. And I think that's the next bit. And to be fair to Nick Bowles, he seems to be giving it a good shot at trying to get that message across the Tory base. Whether it'll happen or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there is quite a lot of enthusiasm for the idea that internally that Nick Bowles, perhaps as well as being quite a nice guy, is a guy who sees himself not as the minister for planning restrictions, but the minister for trying to get planning to work. Which, if he actually manages to pull it off, will be extremely good news.
Yeah, and I think there is a real difference between Nick Bowles and Grant Shapps, because Grant Shapps used the housing brief as an audition for his current role, I think. You know, he touched all the Tory sweet spots, like right to buy, lots and lots of inroads into what we traditionally have always seen as social housing, you know, essentials. Lots of stuff about housing benefits, but not very much stuff about building on the places where the Tory massive lived, because he was auditioning to be their leader, or if they're not their leader, their chairman. And I think Nick Bowles is a very different kind of politician, and I have a lot more time for his approach. For me, I agree with Mark Thompson that housing is key. The other thing that I would like to see recognised is skills and a real sense, you know, post the Richards Review into apprenticeships, of investment into the future of people's skills and making sure that that's, I mean, again, I should declare an interest. I do work in this area, but I think it is absolutely essential to retrain ourselves into being a 21st century workforce, which we are not currently.
Has anyone had any whispers about what actually might be in it rather than what we think might be in it?
I did hear they might be dropping the idea. So this is not what's going to be in it, but something that we thought was going to be in it that's not, which is, please God, this is true, the dropping of the taking away housing benefit from under 25-year-olds.
Yeah, I saw a rumour about that today, and I hope that's true as well, because that seemed very wrong-headed to me.
You conferred that, yeah. I think the I'm very hopeful from the mutterings I've been hearing, and certainly from the attitudes of some members of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, that something on shale gas may very well be in it. And I think, you know, if you're George Osborne looking at this document, then having something hopefully that sounds relatively new, and that also that he can talk about as a potential success story, I think will be something that's very attractive. I mean, that's separate to whether or not you think that's the case. I do think it would be new and a success story, obviously, but I can see the attraction of him trying to bring in something that hasn't been talked about before, particularly in autumn statements or budgets.
Yeah, and politically, I can absolutely see where he's coming from. And I think, to be fair, the government have given up their greenest government ever agenda completely. So why not go hell for leather on fracking? Because they're not going to lose anything that they haven't already lost with the Green lobby.
Yeah, I can certainly sympathise with that. As happens, you know, I think there are some cases to be made. That, I mean, the government still seems to be pushing with various elements of its subsidies for heavy subsidising effect of renewables. Obviously, we've seen the recent arguments within DEC about what kind of energy is or is not going to continue going ahead. But I think whatever they decide to do on the renewable side, I wouldn't be too surprised to hear them portray the question of UK shale gas as being something that actually goes hand in hand with renewables. How do you get your base load for when, say, the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining? And I think the question of going for gas, preferably from the UK, rather than coal, for example, I think that's a relatively compelling argument that I wouldn't be too surprised to hear him make.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily agree with the topic, but I think that they will try to present the argument in that way. I just think that they have kind of lost their capital that they built up a lot between 2005 and 2010. And I knew because I was running CIRA at that point. So, you know, watching the Green groups flock to Cameron was really difficult time for us. But I think they have, from what I get from the environmental lobby, absolutely lost that relationship now. So there's no, you know, while they can make that argument over their heads and make it directly to the public, they're not as hung up on ensuring they get that third party endorsement.
Absolutely, and I think on the electoral basis, I think they're right to make that decision. I think if you look at the pre-crash views on how much people are willing to spend extra on their energy bills for being green, for example, I suspect those positions have changed an awful lot. And I think if you were to ask a lot of pollsters, you know, if there's a general election tomorrow, do you think the party would be wise to talk about the links it's building with groups, or do you think it would be wise to talk about how it's going to bring down energy bills? And or, you know, from my point of view, what they should be doing is looking to break the control of the big six in the energy market. I think the latter option would be the one they go for.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, politically, you're completely right. Whether it's whether we're going to see with environmentalism what we've seen with housing, and they'll suddenly come to a point where it's too late to have fixed it and we have a crisis, remains to be seen. But I think that may be where we land. And I'm afraid this is going to have to be where we land. Mark Wallace, thank you ever so much for joining us this evening. It's really much appreciated. And Mark, thank you as always. Do either of you want to have any last words?
No, I'm good.
No,
thank you.
You covered everything I was going to rant about.
Okay, finally, I'd just like to thank Audioboo for hosting the podcast. It's very kind of them. And hopefully this will be up and running and downloadable as soon as possible.